Now, of course, in the fall of 73, the oil price explosion occurred.
Yom Kippur War.
Plus coinciding with the Arab boycott of the U.S. Now, how did the State Department respond to this?
The immediate concern, of course, was military related, and so that the efforts to keep the U.S. Navy supplied, and we were, of course, in the throes of. Had we withdrawn from Vietnam by then? I guess we had.
In the midst of it.
We were right in the midst of it. That was
maybe over.
It gets fuzzy because my concerns were immediate in Iran. Mm-hmm. But I believe we were still in the throes of withdrawing in any case, and concerned about the possible spread of war in South Asia. And we were, of course, concerned for Japan and its continued well-being. And we were concerned with the resupply of our own fleet in the Indian Ocean and Diego Garcia and coming east for and all the rest of it. So that the efforts at the time were directed towards assuring that oil was available to us in whatever way. And the Shah cooperated. He did not observe the boycott. Indeed, there are some Arabs who feel that he conspired to keep Israel supplied. But I suspect there may be something to that. I don't know.
Did he supply Israel?
Always. Iran was one of the major suppliers of Israel for years.
Did he increase production at the same time the boycott was going on to compensate for some of
the... Well, he promised the Arabs that he would not increase production, as I recall, that he was not going to take advantage of it. By that time, he was beginning to be concerned about conservation himself, about how long in the future his oil supplies would last.
In terms of the actual price increase, he took a fairly hawkish position, though.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. He felt that it's a scarce commodity, it was going to get scarcer, and so let's make up for all the past sins against us and put the oil price where it belongs, truly.
How much of an effort was there, in a diplomatic sense, to try to moderate the
Shah?
Yeah.
I never had the sense that we were trying to moderate the price from a price point of view. We were always grateful to him and willing to go along because he made the supplies available. That was the utmost consideration.
Stability in that aspect.
Right.
Now, before the price explosion, I think it's September 73, I think Libya raised some prices at this point. Nixon gave a speech where he said that the West would treat OPEC like it had treated Mossadegh in 52, 53 by denying OPEC countries markets for oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did anybody take that seriously?
If they did, it was very momentary, because by then it was clear we didn't have control of OPEC. And I frankly don't remember the speech.
Yeah, I just saw this today.
It was a great ho-hummer, I would think. Because by then, Mr. Nixon was in deep yogurt himself,
mm-hmm.
and his leadership was non-existent.
Now, was there any kind of an effort made to find ways to bring prices down or check price increases by applying a...
No, not that I can.
Yeah.
None that I can see.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have worked in the event, and I think that was we were dealing with a fait accompli, and we were dealing with the need to try to make the best of it. And that was, again, the episode I recounted about going to the central bank took place. We were finding ways to recycle these vast numbers of dollars that we were suddenly getting. And that was our major diplomatic effort.
I've got the sense that Nixon and Kissinger had some hope that they could bring oil prices down by dividing the OPEC countries among themselves. Was there any, do you have any sense that that was a desire?
If they had that sense, it certainly wasn't imparted down to the embassy, at least down to my level. I think had we been asked for a view on that as a policy effort, I would have tried to discourage it. We really had to deal with the immediate effects rather than trying to roll back the clock.
Okay. Was there much concern at the embassy or in Washington that the U.S. and Western Europe and Japan might somehow start competing for assets to energy supplies?
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And there was some of that. There was great concern that Japan was, well, let me back up.
Mm-hmm.
In the heady days for Iran, of those vast oil price increases, there are a number of court cases still going on resulting from efforts to sign long-term agreements with NIOC, and Ashla has one somewhere along the line. The Japanese signed long-term agreements at great prices. There was concern that oil would not be available, and there would be shortages, of, that the Arab boycott would be reinstated. The whole variety of fears came along in the event that proven groundless. But at the time, it was real, because you had Japan, after all, controlled the majority of the tanker fleet, Japan and the Greeks. In order to keep Japan Incorporated going, you had to have tankers going every day. So it was to their interest to sign long-term agreements, and so they went ahead and did it. And there were people coming to Iran in early 74, from the damnedest places in the United States, trying to sign up long-term agreements, trying to bribe people, trying to do all kinds of those silly things in order to assure themselves of oil supplies. And some of the joint projects that were underway, especially utilizing gas, foundered because of the increase in prices. One with Transco, for instance, in the United States, a major developer. It was going to be a major developer in the sea structure down in the first Gulf. They had to back off.
Well, I read that during the first energy crisis, some of the Europeans were concerned that the U.S. might use its political clout to negotiate bilateral agreements with key Middle East oil sources, which would effectively preempt supplies that otherwise would have gone to Europe or Japan. Was there any discussion of bilateral agreements by the guy in the State Department?
This was not in the American tradition.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to my knowledge, if it was considered, it was considered in the abstract in Washington, not as a reality. The Shah was quite willing to sign long-term agreements, but we preferred to let the market play.
Okay. Now, in the long term, Kissinger supported a policy of cooperation. The U.S. supported the development of the International Energy Authority to bring Western countries in a cooperative stance. This is in 74 also. the State Department officials see the IEA as sort of a potential counter cartel to OPEC? Have you seen it that way, or it's not that you were involved in that at all? I mean,
my involvement was minimal because by that time I was withdrawing from Iran. I left Iran in the summer of 74 and went to Barcelona as consul general.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, my involvement during the greater part of 74 was simply not there. I did talk to a lot of oil people when I came back to Washington before I went out to Spain and so on down the line, but I just don't recall any serious discussion of I whatever it is, being viewed as a counterpoise to OPEC.
Okay. Now this might have occurred before that, I'm not sure, but I read the Robert McNamara and Hollis Chenery at the World Bank believed that the U.S. would fail in any case to get OPEC to lower prices, and that instead the U.S. should encourage OPEC to organize the recycling of oil revenues to assist countries that cannot pay for oil on their
own.
That's
right. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall any discussion of this proposal?
Oh yeah, well yeah, that was part and parcel of what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
We pushed hard around the world for the oil countries to recycle their gains that they couldn't immediately use into ways that would make it possible for the less fortunate countries to survive. And the thought did not occur to the Shah until he pushed it up. Mm-hmm. And then he took it as he made something out of it for his own grandeur. And it was fine. I thought it was a great gesture.
Now, I think one development that did occur before you left in the summer was, I think, at least the initiative to organize what was called the U.S.-Iran Joint Economic Commission.
Yes.
Did you do much work on the commission before you left, or?
No.
I think it was in April. It was sort of proposed.
Yeah, it was proposed, and it was we were studying what we were going to do, who was going to fund what, how much money the Iranians were going to put up, but it was not a reality by the time I left. And in the event, the Iranians didn't want to put up any money, unlike the Saudis. You know, This was a sort of a fashionable thing to do with all the oil-rich countries. We had the joint council with the Saudi Arabians, we had with Iran. Don't know whether we ever did one with Venezuela, but probably we did, and so on down the line.
What are the general purposes of the commission?
General purposes were to discuss problems areas on an official level. And at the same time, we organized the U.S.-Iran Business Council as a private sector adjunct to the Joint Economic Council, and I took part in that.
Later on?
No,
was it at that time?
At the time, in the first meetings of that, and then when I came back as a businessman, I took part in it from the business point of view. Walter Suri, Surrey and Morris, was very active. Hank Greenberg from AIG was very active. American International Group Insurance guy. The head of it was a guy from IOP, International Oil Pipelines, or something rather, from Iowa, as I recall. And Tennessee from Allied.
Yeah, like chemical?
Yeah. And a few others.
Mm-hmm. To what extent was the commission seen as a means to ensure that U.S. exporters got a large share of the market that would be developing as oil revenues increased?
Well, that was our aim, of course.
Yeah.
To make sure that the American share of the market was either constant or increased. And and to smooth out the methods for increasing American involvement in the Iranian economy, and to help the Iranians export other things than oil to the United States. And we met periodically. We got a few things done, but nothing overly overwhelming.
Let me back to this oil thing one other aspect of it. I mean, did Richard Helms meet with the Shah to discuss OPEC questions periodically? Did
he
express concern about price increases? Or?
Well, I can't say that. I don't know that he expressed concern about price increases. It was the other aspects of it, the recycling and so on, that were necessary to be discussed. And the military supply, which was overwhelming. But he was willing to sell us, for instance, oil for our strategic reserve, but at a price. But then he wanted a long-term agreement, which we weren't willing to sign at any rate.
Okay. And when you were a businessman and ran in the late 70s, well, I'll get to this later on. That aside for now.
Don't worry about it.
Okay. I'd like to go back a few years earlier to Nixon's visit to Iran in 72,
mm-hmm.
on his way back from the Moscow summit. Now, was the embassy given much advance notice about this visit by the President and the Secretary?
No, not really a lot. We knew about it. We knew it was in the cards because, naturally, any presidential visit requires a great deal of security being laid on and so on down the line. And but our participation
there was no sense, you didn't get any real sense at that time of Nixon's or Kissinger's purposes in visiting the
Shah. None whatever. The purpose was just to say to brief him on the results of his summit in the Soviet Union, and was a great builder for the Shah's ego. But apart from that, we had no sense that that was when they were going to anoint him as the savior of the Middle East.
There was no discussion of that. Did it filter down the decision?
But you see, Helms wasn't there then.
McFarland was there.
McFarland was there. There was quite a different can of worms. And he'd only been there a couple of weeks.
So. Was McFarland present at the meetings with the Shah and Kissinger and Nixon?
I doubt it. Seriously, he may have been.
You don't know who it was?
No. Because Nixon and Kissinger were staying up at the palace. They couldn't have any time.
They were in the stratosphere.
Yeah.
Now, the policy, though, did filter down.
Rather soon, as a matter of fact. Because the Iranians were very, the Shah himself was very proud of the whole thing and wanted it known that he was a chosen instrument.
But this was confirmed by cables from Washington at the time, eventually.
Over time,
And you got a sense of the arms sales approach that was discussed at the same time?
Yes, because that was when Henry Kearns and I were discussing how we were going to use $1 billion worth of Ex-Im money.
Henry Kearns, he's from the bank.
He was the head of the Ex-Im Bank.
Okay. And the idea being the Shah could use the money as he pleased?
Yeah,
is that?
Pretty much.
Now, was this a big departure from previous policy and practice?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We had been very, very chary, very cautious about the kinds of things and the amount of money that we thought the Shah should spend on his military. And there was suddenly to be able to say, well, here's half a billion or a billion. Let's get our military together and decide how we're going to spend it. It was essentially the way it was approached, not on what they could usefully absorb, was a real departure. When General Twitchell was head of MAG, his every effort was to make sure that whatever it was the Iranian military got, they were prepared to absorb and use before they got it.
Without any waste, sir.
Without any waste, but as little waste as possible.
Yeah.
And that flip-flopped the whole policy.
But up through May 72, that was the practice.
That was the practice, right.
Hmm. Did you know at that time if there had been any interagency discussion in Washington of this whole issue? Was it debated, the pros and cons?
No, I have no knowledge.
Yeah. Okay. I have some questions about sort of business government relations,
sure,
other than oil,
mm-hmm,
during this period. I've read, and I don't know how true this is, that beginning in the late 1960s, U.S. banks began to move heavily into Iran.
Yes, that's true.
When
you say heavily,
there's a considerable
presence. And Citibank, for instance, was a partner with Hassan Ali Abdelhaj in Iranian's bank. And David Rockefeller and Chase and Manny Haney and Chemical and Irving Trust, Bankers Trust, Pacific Security, you name the lot of them, Mellon Bank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, they all had people either stationed in Tehran or in Lebanon, or coming through often, because when the Shah or when the central bank floated a loan, 100 million here, 40 million there, whatever, it was by and large syndicated, and all of these banks took part in it. And as time went on, and one of the closest advisors to Mehdi Sami, for instance, in his days, the central bank, was Minos Zambonakis, who was at that time with Manufacturers Hanover and later was the first bank of Boston.
Yeah.
I think it was first bank of Boston.
Now, as these banks were setting up offices and so forth, did they consult with the embassy when they made their plans or plan major investments? Did they
they came and talked to us, yeah, about the general economic fundamentals.
Okay.
They came and talked about who was who in the banking business, who was trustworthy, who was not. But once in a while they would come and talk to us about whether or not they should fund a particular investment or not. But by and large, they made their own decisions.
They just wanted information.
Right.
Now, apparently, I guess Citibank and Chase had a very competitive relationship,
yes,
in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Did this cause any problems?
No.
No. I've read that a central bank complained about Citibank's practices and that Citibank had to withdraw some of its people at some point.
Yeah, well, they got a little aggressive. And they were moving into areas where the Iranians didn't feel they should move. And yes, they did withdraw one fellow, I think he was named. That was part of Abdelhaj's operation. And Citibank was trying to use the Abdelhaj connection for whatever it was worth.
Mm-hmm. Were there any visits by David Rockefeller to Iran while you were there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Well, among other things, Chase Bank was known as the Shaw's Bank.
His personal bank?
Yeah, all the bankers' trusts also did a lot of royal family business, or I should say imperial family business. Chase would lead the consortium on occasion when major lending operations were put together. But they did have a small piece of the Industrial Mining and Development Bank, along with Continental Illinois, I think it was, of all people. And then later on, these several banks started private banks in association with other American banks. But by 1974, the only full-blown joint venture was the Iranians Bank.
The Citibank?
Yeah.
When Rockefeller came to Iran, did he stop by the embassy and meet with people, or is it more complicated than that?
Sometimes, the ambassador would have a party for David, but more often the Shah would have a party for David and the ambassador would be present. Or when we had the big financial conference there in 72, it was led by David Rockefeller and all kinds of other businessmen. Don Reagan was there, from Merrill Lynch, and Bob Aboud, and so on. There was an all-star cast. Whenever David came to town, he had audiences with the Shah on a regular basis.
To what extent was the embassy's function sort of to encourage investment?
I considered that to be one of my functions. Major function, however, was to try to find sales for my staff, was try to help the American business find sales and partners, or to collect, as the case may be. It's strange, but you got the feeling that American business wasn't all that interested in investments. They were interested in financing investment with local resources and carrying the profits home. I became a little disenchanted with some of my stalwart American risk-taking businessmen.
They wanted joint ventures.
They wanted joint ventures, but locally financed, and make their participation comprise of the technology and some very expensive American talent, and so forth and so on. Didn't work. Because the Brits and the Japanese and the Germans were willing to do other things.
But in general, though, I guess you talked about this big bankers' conference in 72. Was it the sense that this was to be growing national income that would make investments on loans more likely and possible?
Exactly. Yeah. And this was the purpose of the conference was to introduce a lot of American businessmen to Iran who had never been there before. And the Iranians really put on a great show. They really did.
The embassy helped set it up?
The embassy worked on it, but it was set up by the Iranians themselves, at the initiative of David Rockefeller.
Okay. What kind of problems did U.S. companies have in doing business in Iran in this period?
Well, corruption was always a problem. Who to pay off? There were people with hands out all the time. And it reached up into the royal family, more often than not. Beginning to get the early, the evening rush is setting in. And finding the right partner with the right degree of expertise and the a certain amount of sophistication, both financially as well as technically, was really one of the greatest problems. Financial resources.
Maybe better.
Stop for now.
Yeah.
Or because.